Q&A. Q&A.
So it's 11. Go to 11:30.
Oh, let's see what Clark is yet. Clearly, everybody's flexible here.
The treatment center guys had to go.
Oh, they had to go?
Yeah. He said people didn't get up and walk out. They had to go back to the treatment center.
Fucking treatment center.
So as you guys, as you guys have witnessed, we have a lot of opinions. All right, Jaden, you got it. Good job. No, no, he's perfect. He's perfect.
Good job, Eddie.
They help you meet God.
So anyway, we would love to share our experience, strength, and hope with our experience in working with others, countless people. So, anybody got any questions? We're going to break for lunch already. Come on.
Yes.
The whole God thing. Have you ever experienced just not using the word God deliberately because it's a good reaction it provokes as opposed to not? I'm hung up on the word power.
I'm sorry?
I said I'm hung up, when I talk about it, I talk about opening to power instead of opening to God, because nobody knows what I mean by power.
Right.
And they have lots of preconceptions about that. And always seem to be a fairly simple way of avoiding the question of recognition. I'll tell you, they use the power X times in the book. The word higher twice, so it's greater power, not higher power. But I wondered if
I use manager. I use manager.
Repeat the question, please.
Yes, do we use a different word other than God when we're working with people and stuff, because there's so much baggage that people bring in and put on the table when you say God? And that's my experience. Personally, and this is just my personal feeling, is I react very negatively to that term. I don't like it. I think it's stupid. And that's where I go with that. And that's just me. So when I work with guys, you know, I talk about, you know, the essence, the oneness of all things, and just as a short thing, I just talk about the manager. You know, the what's going on is, you know, I'm powerless, you know, over absolutely everything. I need to align myself with the power. That's what the steps are guiding me towards. I'm going to turn my life and will over to what already has it anyway. You know, it's clear to me that I'm no longer separate. You know, that's the illusion. That's the Maya. You know, I can't possibly be separate from nature. So what I'm trying to do is come together with it, to have a consciousness that understands it. And I believe what Alcoholics Anonymous does is it subtracts away from us anything that is blocking us from being able to see the truth of that, that we are all connected, that we are all part of the same thing, all of us. This guru friend of mine, I was talking to him about, you know, there really is no separation between people. You know, there's this illusion that there's a standalone, unique entity called Bill Cleveland. He looked at me and laughed, and he says, "Oh, you're in the intermediate phase." And I thought, that's pretty good, man. I felt I'm intermediate, man. You know, I'm not a beginner anymore, you know. And I said, "So what?" He says, "Well, the real truth seems to be, that there is Bill Cleveland has certain tastes, likes, and dislikes, and mannerisms. He comes from a certain place. The problem is the attachment we have to that. And this egoic mind tells us that we are like this, and we attempt to become like it is thinking we should be. there's the essence of the problem, is this attachment to this very third-dimensional egoic mind that lives in the past or in the future, never in the present moment where there's nothing to do. So once you see that in meditation, you can separate yourself from your thinking mind. It isn't the great benefit that you once thought it was. It's really good adding up columns of figures and reading, but as far as interpersonal relationships, whoa, you know, it's not a really good. So evidently there must be this manager, this oneness, this unicity. Something is happening. Is it conscious or anthropomorphic? Does it think and know that? Is it a conscious of me? Well, who the hell knows? You know, true faith, real faith, is not knowing and having that be okay. That everything is just absolutely as it should be all the time. It could not possibly be any different than it is. And all is well. Nothing's wrong. Ever. I have difficulty with that, but I have faith in it. I think that's really true.
So, Matt the Alcoholic, great question. And, you know, one of the great things about AA, right, is that the reason you're responsible to have a message of depth and weight is you're uniquely capable of helping someone that I can't help.
Yeah.
Because I have my experience. And my experience is I went to Catholic school. And I thought, from my parents paying tuition every month, that they were taking that seriously so that I should fall in line. And I was a pretty open, happy little kid. And my experience, and I'm not saying this is the Catholic Church, this is my experience. That means this is the way I heard it. This is the way I took it in. I'm not sure they were even saying these things, right? But by the time I was done with that, I felt that God hated me. I felt that, well, you know, I remember, this is a story I tell, this did actually happen. Sister Dennis Ann, who's dead, so I can say her by name now, looked at me in eighth grade when I'm 14 going on 15, and I've got hormones like coming out of my forehead, right? And she said, you know, if you're even thinking about sex, you're going to hell. And I was like, oh, God, right? Because I brushed my teeth this morning, so there was like 2 minutes where I didn't think about sex. And then I looked around the room, and I said, well, it's going to be crowded, sister, because I know him, and I know him, and I know what he's thinking about right now. And so I had that impression from things I was told about God, right? And then by the time I got to AA, I had earned a permanent seat in hell, if there was such a thing as hell. But I think God's always kind of communicating through us now, my experience now in this timeless plenitude of being. I'm even more effed up than most because I have a minor in religious studies.
Oh, boy.
So I went to Catholic school. I actually went to the seminary for a month. They used to give you little trial memberships at the seminary. I flunked. But I went home and thought it's not for me, and I really am curious. I don't know if I would be a spiritual seeker as much as I am if I didn't go to Catholic school. But on my father's deathbed, I said, Dad, what do you think, you know? You've been going to church almost every day for the last several years. And he goes, you know what I think about God, Matthew? This is while I'm sober, at his deathbed. He said, I think God's standing on a mountain. I think there's a railroad that goes around the mountain, one track. And there's a train coming this way, and there's a train coming this way. And God can see what's about to happen, and he's thinking, that's a hell of a way to run a railroad. And I said, that's what you believe? After all the crap I've been through at Catholic school, this is what you're leaving me with? And he laughed. So I came with all that. So I am uniquely qualified to help somebody who has that kind of issue, right? But I'll also tell you that I love the way Bill says it, experience, right? My wife, who's not particularly religious or spiritual, right? I pray every night. In fact, the first night we spent together, I knew we were going to spend the night together, and she went in the bathroom. Well, I'm only 1.5, 2 years sober, and I've never not prayed since I got sober. So as soon as she went in the bathroom, I dropped to my knees by the side of the bed, and I'm praying, hoping she won't come out. She came out, and she put her arm against the doorway and said, are you praying for that which I am about to receive? Thank you. And I said, as a matter of fact, I am. And but I pray every night, and she sometimes, I think we've been married 20 years, 3-4 times, she's reached over the bed and held my hand.
Oh.
In 20 years. But she did say to me once when we were talking about God, some sponsees, and he said, you know, it seems to me that if there is a God, it certainly can't be contained in a concept. Any concept of God is heretical,
yeah,
because it's an insult to something that's omnipresent and omnipotent to fit it into a concept. And I'm like, where did this come from? Miss, I'll hold your hand 4 times in 20 years. But so this is what we come to. I mean, Bill tried to describe it. I tried to describe it. And the question was, do you use a different word? What I always say is, don't worry about it. Right? Like, anybody who thinks they worked a third step when they did a third step, that's a little crazy, right? I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of... Because that's where I'm like, I'm just doing this because he told me to. But then I have had moments in my life where I'll call somebody and I'll say, you know, I got this thing. They're doing a background check on me, or, you know, my kid has got this thing. He might be in trouble. And, you know, my wife has got this thing. And they go, and occasionally someone will say, oh, I'm sorry, I thought I was talking to somebody who did a third step. And you go, oh, yeah. Or to put it a more clear example is, I was, after Philippa had her stroke, and the kids were little, and I had a new job, and I was, you know, trying to keep up with my AA stuff and my parenting stuff and my husband stuff and my Matthew self-care program, which wasn't going very well. I was on the 710 freeway, and I started realizing, my brain started going, you're a crappy father. People really knew you, they'd take those kids away. You're a shitty husband. You want everybody to think you're this awesome guy who takes care of his newly disabled wife, but you're crappy. She doesn't feel loved and supported by you. She feels condescended to. You're a terrible employee. God, if they knew the crap you did, the times you knocked off from work, the phone calls you didn't make today, you'd get fired. So I'm imploding on the 710 freeway, and I call Bill, and very rarely does this happen, but Bill didn't answer. Right? So I call Jay. And I explain how terrible I am at my whole life, right? And he laughs. And he says, let's pretend for just a moment that you're not in charge. And then I started laughing, right? And all this stress. And he never said the word God to me. But like Bill says, and another thing this guy, a mutual friend of ours, says, he goes, you're under the delusion that you're the doer, you know? And I watched this really beautiful film about a silent order of monks. And one of the quotes they put up is said, if you look at your life and every great gift you've gotten has been given to you, why do you act as if you earned it? Mm-hmm. And I look at my life and I walked up to a bus stop and met a woman who blew my mind and changed my horizons and raised my standards and continues to teach me with her disabilities and her shortcomings and her love and her wisdom, right? I had sex because I love to have sex. And I got Rory, who wants to talk at 12:30 in the morning about what he's going to do next year. You know, I got Sophie. I got Phoebe. I walked into an AA meeting because it was close to my house. And I got these guys. Why do I act as if I've earned that? And why do I have to put a concept around that? So when I come to speak to you to answer your question, I just say don't worry about it, because let's see what happens. Let's pretend this is true. You know, one of the great orders of the steps is like, well, if a guy says, well, I don't want to do a fourth step, then you go, well, the third step says you turned your will and your life over to the care of God. Let's write the fourth step as if you actually meant that. Mm-hmm. Meaning I'm going to risk daring to tell the whole truth to one other person. That's your first step of proving you're turning your will and your life over to whatever. To whatever's growing my hair and beating my heart, you know. To whatever's making all these amazing coincidences happen. To whatever the stream of life direction is going, maybe you can risk just enough to tell the truth to one person and see what happens.
Thank you. I don't change my approach to make somebody comfortable. That's not my job. I have to be authentic to who I am and to whom what my experience is. I don't apologize to that to anybody. And when I... but I'm kind and I'm patient. and I'm intuitive. Now, you heard that I let Boy wander off on the third step because he was, you know, he wanted to talk about, you know, deism and all this other stuff, you know, and I just didn't have the bandwidth for it. And and I wasn't that interested, and he could talk forever, and I just, you know, and so I skipped it. It was self care. Knowing that if he stayed with the process, that what I would call, I knew that he'd done the third step. In that he was doing everything that I asked him to do. And that the jousting over the order of this thing was not going to be productive to anyone. And so I honored his experience and his intellectual nonsense. I don't honor it, but I just skipped it.
I didn't honor it.
It's stupid. I didn't say you're stupid. I said it's stupid.
Called me stupid before, though.
But so there's that part of it. Now in the book, one of the things that, now back to my experience of Alcoholics Anonymous, 1979 to about 1990, everybody that I work with generally has had some experience in a classical religious thing. They've been sent to Sunday school, something like that. Post-1990, we're in the post-Christian era. And at least in Southern California. Let's talk about what. So those conversations aren't the same anymore. Now, one of the things that's been most helpful when we get to step three, which is where the real God question comes up, is it says here in the book that we found it desirable, blah, blah, blah. The wording, of course, was quite optional so long as we expressed the idea of voicing it without reservation. Now, I'm generally speaking to a man who only is parroting opinions of other people about religion and about God. They don't have any personal experience. The only prayer they are familiar with is maybe they were given, "Now I lay me down to sleep," by a grandparent, or parroting the prayers in the rooms. So what I do is I have them write their own third step prayer in their own words. What this does, and then I have them write it in their book. What this does, and at the same time, I will write my own. You know, and my own are things like, "Dude, it's me again. I'm under the illusion that I am controlling something. Please remove from me anything that I may think about how things should be so that I may receive what it is that you have for me to perceive and enjoy this day." And I have them write theirs in their book. That may be the first prayer they've ever said. And it's theirs. And it's in their words. And it's not it'll use whatever terminology they wish to use. So that's how I do that. Now, the other thing is that I am also very, very committed to the fact that everybody gets to sit at the table in AA, and that there is no fealty. One of the things that I'm the most fortunate man you've ever met, all of you, except yourself. But my experience is that I have a wonderful relationship with the author of this book. I've read hundreds and hundreds of his personal letters as research to something that I'm working on. He talks about the steps being only there to be taken in whatever order and whatever time a person does. Now, I think that's absolutely heresy. Kick that guy out now. Now. But, you know, Bill was an atheist. He would not create an organization where any atheist or agnostic couldn't be. And I had the good fortune, because I still show up where my sponsor says he's going to show up. I showed up at the first ever international conference of We Agnostics, Atheists and Freethinkers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and went.
I went with him.
Yeah. And we went so that we would have an experience and not an opinion. And I one of the greatest privileges in this world is getting a new friend and a colleague on this path. And one of my dear my new friends is a guy by the name of Joe C. And he wrote a book called Beyond Belief: Musings for Atheists and Agnostics on the 12-Step Path. Get the book. Get the book. It's really good. It's really good. And he is he's a committed an AA member, and I'm very, very proud to have him be a friend of mine. We do some stuff together, and right now they've got a thing in Toronto where they've kicked him out of the AA, the agnostic meetings, and it's just hilarious, you know. But we can go into all that, but back to this thing about what is it that we have? What are we passing on? I am not passing on a belief in God. I pass my experience on. As William James said, experience trumps theology. Okay? Experience trumps anything in the mind. Okay? And I've got my experiences, and I can talk about them using the G word or not using the G word, but I use the G word because that's me. Okay? And that's what I... But it's important for me to continue to pass on this legacy of a recovery from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The consciousness of my awareness of the presence comes from the action, not from the belief. I don't believe, then I do. I do, and then I interpret the experience. This is what I do with people. But I don't, you know, I mean, we're going through a book that was written in the mid-30s, and I'm not gonna apologize for them, nor am I gonna make it easy for you. You know, I mean, but I also am gonna be I'm gonna respond to my own intuition.
Anybody else? Yeah.
So, could you explain your experience, how it's changed from when you first started sponsoring to now, or if it hasn't changed? On if you have, like, if there's things that a sponsor will do that you will say, I won't sponsor you anymore, because I have issues with that sometimes, with drawing that line. So, I'm wondering if you, and if you do something that you say you won't sponsor anymore, what is it?
So, Bill, I'll start youngest to oldest.
He's the cute beetle.
So I'm Paul. So I was told, Bill told me not to fire him, but let's take the first part of the sentence. How has sponsorship changed over time? Well, obviously, if I'm developing the art of helping other people, it changes quite profoundly. And I'll give you a really short, I always prefer the experiential stories than we launch it. We all launch into conceptual thinking, which I love about us. But I lived in an apartment complex, right, with my wife when we were first together. And at night, I'd come home from the airline, sometimes around midnight, and there'd be this glow of a cigarette in the corner by the pool. And I started talking to this guy, and he's a drunk guy in his 20s. He lives with his dad, who's a recently born-again Christian with the new, very young trophy wife. Awesome situation for this kid. And he's a drunk, you know, sitting by the pool every night.
And he kept saying to me, you know, I almost was a pro surfer. He brought that up a lot. And, you know, I live with my dad, and I'm, you know, and he's drunk all the time. And I told him I was sober, and he kind of looked at me. And then a couple of nights later, I said, hey, almost pro surfer, when are you going to do something about it? And he looked at me and said, F you, dude. And I totally betrayed everything I learned in this book. Because I would come at this, hey, I'm with the Gestapo of AA, man. I know everything, and I'm going to shove it down your throat. So what I learned then is a few months later, he's sitting by the pool again, and I came home in a different mood. I actually came home from a meeting. And I said, how you doing? And he goes, I'm all right. And I said, really? I said, do you drink in your bedroom? And he said, yeah. I said, so is your bedroom, because his apartment was like my apartment, is it at the end or the close to the door? And he goes, it's at the end. I go, so you got to time when you leave your room to get out the door so they don't know you're drunk. And he goes, yeah. And I go, God, I hate that part. That sucks, huh? And he's like, yeah, that sucks. How do you know? And I go, because that's what I did for years, whether it was with girls I was living with or parents or college roommates. I always acted like I wasn't doing what I was doing. And, man, it's lonely, isn't it? He goes, yeah, it's lonely. I said, you miss surfing? He goes, I really miss surfing. And he went to the meeting with me the next week. So how I've adjusted, it's a little story, but how I've adjusted in sponsorship is, A, I learned from Bill, try not to get involved in their drama. I'm not a marriage counselor. I have pretended to be one. And I don't know if I've helped or hurt. I really don't know. Certainly didn't. It wasn't neutral. what I constantly try to do is, hey, let's get back to this book. Let's get back to this book. Let's get back to this book. So do I have a line where I don't sponsor people because I'm not comfortable with them? No, I just don't. They don't come do their stuff at my house. You know, what happened, the one time I let a guy go, and I asked Bill about it, is, and this will happen. People will come to you and say, I want what you have. And then they'll call you and complain about their lives or their wives or their jobs or how everything sucks. And you go, hey, well, let's get together and read the book. And then they don't show up. And then they call and complain about their wives and their lives and their jobs. And then the third or fourth time, through training, I say, you know, you approached me because you wanted the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's really what I have to offer you. I'm not interested in listening to you right now. If you want to come to my house and read the book and start on a path where these things take care of themselves, let's do it. If not, I'm not here for that. I'm a sponsor in AA. I'm not a free therapist who has to listen to you. If you want what I have, this is what Bill always says to say, do what I do. You don't do what I do, and you're not getting what I've got. So that's one way to thin out the herd. But the one time I did let a guy go is he wanted to tell everybody I was his sponsor. But I said, you know, he'd never done a four-step. He was a hoarder. He couldn't stay employed. And I said, look, just write one name down. And for 6 months, he wouldn't write one name down. So I said, I'm giving you 7 days to write a name down. If you don't write a name down, get another sponsor. And he said, well, you don't fire people. I said, you'd be quitting. And 7 days later.
Forced resignation.
Yeah, he did not write a name down. And I said, I'm no longer your sponsor. Please don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor and stop calling me. And he was sober a long time, 5 or 6 years. Well, he has since done a fifth step. He isn't a hoarder anymore. And he made amends to me, which he didn't need to do. But he came to me and said, you know, you were just trying to help me, right? So do you see what I mean? If I'm not involved in their drama, there's nothing to fire them over. Do I feel comfortable with everything people say to me? No. Hell no. But I don't have. But I feel comfortable with the path on the map, and I know if we walk to the places that are designated on the map and dig, they will get well. So that's my answer.
What did I do?
Oh, can't take us anywhere.
I have an announcement. My daughter is in labor.
Yeah.
I suspect she's been having sex with her husband. Speculation.
Oh, her name's Mary.
Yeah. Second grandchild, second boy.
Awesome.
Yeah, very exciting. You don't have to fire them. they just go away. You know, I have a rule. You never fire them. That's how you learn patience and tolerance. But that doesn't mean I'm going to be nice to you. You know, I mean, I will tell you things that you may not want to hear. You know, I haven't fallen victim to this lie that goes around AA that we don't give advice or express opinions. If we didn't do those two things, we wouldn't have anything to say to each other, you know. And if you ask me for advice, I'll give you some advice. Like, you know, most of it's very simple, you know. He told me one time, I was complaining about my wife, and I said, we got into this big screaming fight, and he goes, stop yelling at her. And he clearly hadn't been listening to me. And I said, but she said, he goes, stop yelling at her. He wasn't interested in what she said. You know, he wanted me to stop yelling at my wife. And that's the kind of stuff we're talking about. You know, don't yell at her. Stop dancing. That kind of thing. The thing about rejecting certain people, I have this whole little rant that I do about people on medication, drug addicts in AA. And I did my little rant one time, and this woman came up to me after the meeting, and she said, this girl asked me to sponsor her, but she's a cocaine addict, and I've never done cocaine. So I told her, no. What do you think? And I said, well, you're never going to learn about cocaine addiction now, you know, because you sent her away. And I think you'd find it quite interesting, you know. The reason God gave alcoholics cocaine is so we could drink more. That's exactly what it's for. You know, people that do it all by itself without drinking, they can go to those other meetings. You know? I don't get those people. You know. Second thing is I think I told her, I said, and I believe this very strongly, I don't think the girl needs any help with her cocaine addiction. I think she's got that down pretty good. You know, but you know about recovery, don't you? And I believe that's what she's looking for. And if she's anything like you, she's probably ended up in a state of incomprehensible demoralization. Who cares what the vehicle was? Okay? Now, how do I know? Because I'm not in charge of this process. I did not solicit this person to come to me and ask for help. They came voluntarily. Walked across the room and asked me for help. I do not believe that is a mistake that needs to be filtered by me. You know, my thinking is very prejudiced, narrow, and I will preclude myself from having an experience that may very well change my entire life. I know about recovery. I don't care what your problem is. Now, if it isn't going to work out, maybe you need to hang on to me for a while until you find the right person to be with. That's happened to me a lot over the years. Somebody will grab a hold of me and come along, and all of a sudden they disappear. This guy was showing up at my office real regular for quite a long time, and he just disappeared. Years later, I go to this meeting that I never go to, and I just popped in there. And this guy taps me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and I look at him, and he goes, you remember me? And I remembered his face. I said, well, yeah, I remember you. What happened to you? And he goes, well, ever since I got rid of you and got this other guy, I've been doing great. And he laughed. I laughed. We hugged each other. It was just like, and that's exactly what happened. You know, he says, that guy's a pain in the ass. I need to find somebody else. And he just wandered off, you know. And, I mean, some people you click with, some you don't. But I don't need to control the experience. People on medication. That's a big one. It's a big one in our area. You'll hear lots of people express opinions that just absolutely screw me into the ceiling, you know. Now, I've experienced people that are truly bipolar. I've seen that demon. I've looked it in the eye and seen it. This guy walked across my living room one time, curled up in my lap. He's a 40-year-old grown man. Put his head in my neck and just started sobbing and crying at the pain of just being alive, sober. Now, that's not normal. My wife walked through the living room and saw that, and she went, whoa. I mean, that'll get your attention. People have demons I don't have. And evidently, in my arrogance, if I don't have that demon, I somehow believe you're faking it. Why would you do that? I mean, question number one. Why would you fake being like that, being in that much pain? We got this guy to go to a doctor. They checked his blood levels and gave him some medication, and he's better. He's sober today. This was years ago. People on medication, are people being over-medicated? Oh, absolutely. They hand it out like candy, and I don't agree. There's a lot of stuff I don't agree with. But in our area, all these young kids that are coming into the recovery industry, they're all medicated. You know, all of them have been on shit since they were 11 or 12 years old. You know, if they stay sober, they'll probably sort that out. So when some kid comes to me, and he's 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, when they hit 30, I make myself stop calling them children, you know, because they're staying sober now for long periods of time. If they come and they come up to me, and they're totally politically incorrect. They're tweakers, they're crackheads, they maybe did a little drinking, they've sent them to AA. What am I supposed to do? Weed them out? Am I the filter at the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag? You know, should we check them at the door and make sure they're correctly alcoholic enough to come to our meeting? You know, they come and you ask for help and you give them some help. Do the best you can. Tell them how to behave in AA. They're looking for that. They want somebody to take them by the hand. They maybe have never had anybody that they could really look up to, feel close to. I tell them, you're not broken. You're just fine, man. It couldn't have been any different than it is. My experience with that is, as time goes by, if they stay sober and they grab a hold of it, which a lot of them have, they will wean themselves off the medication. They don't want to be on it. They don't want to be on it. They want to be sober. When they wean themselves off, the real problems will present themselves or not. And it'll work itself out. I can't work it out for them. I'm not a doctor. Have I learned a lot about medication over the years? Absolutely. I got a couple of guys that are like a physician's desk reference. So I swear to God, this is true. A guy will come to me and he goes, they got me on my, I said, what are you taking? The guy says, Risperidol. And I call Kevin, and I go, Kevin, what's Risperidol? He goes, whoa. I go, really? He goes, oh, that's a bad one, that's a bad one. They give it to schizophrenics, you know, to stop the voices. And I said, well, Kevin, do you have voices? He goes, not anymore. So you learn. Pay attention. Open your ears. Don't be afraid of it. They can't hurt us. The atheists can't hurt us. The medicated people can't hurt us. The drug addicts have been destroying Alcoholics Anonymous since 1935. Any minute, the whole goddamn thing is going to collapse from the sheer weight of the crackheads, you know? You know, it's like, they can't hurt us. And this whole idea of identification has gone way off the track to me, as far as I'm concerned. Way off the track. I believe in singleness of purpose. I believe in separate programs for separate problems. But how separate are the problems? We make the decisions to start separate 12-step programs because we so desperately want to be different. You know, how different is a junkie from an alcoholic? Really? I mean, if you boil it down, how different are they? Don't they end up in the same place we end up in? You know? I mean, drug addicts are a little hipper. You know, they would never call the police on themselves like I did. You know, there are some subtle differences, you know. You know, they're a little bit more criminal than the alcoholic. Like Matthew says, the alcoholic's always attempting to do something. The drug addicts actually complete the robbery. You know, because they're wide awake and armed. You know? But as far as recovery is concerned, you know, I just don't waste a lot of time worrying about the differences.
God never puts two people together to only help one. I have no idea why you're in front of me.
Yeah.
I have no idea. My only job is to listen, to give whatever instruction I can. The other thing is that nowadays what happens is when, because I don't get many new people. I mean, I wouldn't talk to anybody over 4 years sober when I was new. You know, I just wouldn't. And if somebody had over 10, I'd leave the room just because I was afraid I'd mess myself. And but when a man comes to me now, what I do is the first thing I do when he's asking me to sponsor him or we're getting into the conversation is I give him a piece of paper and a pencil, and I said, write down your fears. I'll be back in 20 minutes. And then, you know, let's get it out. Because they're coming. If you come to me, you're in serious trouble. You know, I mean, and we got to get triage going now. I'm not going to go back and read the book. Let's get the tourniquet. Let's go. And so that's what I do, because they, you know, it's, she's going to leave me, they're going to fire me, you know, all the stuff that, you know, guys have been sober a while, you know, they're going to find out. And so, I mean, that's, if you talk about, you know, practical thing about sponsoring people, with folks that are down the line, somebody's approaching me, give me your fears. We can go back and start this later, but let's get that out now. It's like lancing the boil. And so that's a real good practical thing that I think that anybody could do, you know, when you're having that first conversation, because you can let them know, you know, they're alcoholic males. I mean, come on, how complex is it? You're all right. You know, come back, we can deal with that, you know. Oh, you're afraid. Really? We've got a section on that. No problem. You know, we're in the right place. So there's that. The other thing is that I trust the evolution of the collective. I trust it.
Wait, the evolution of what?
Of the collective.
The collective.
In other words, we're going along and it's going to be fine. And whatever your path is, the person that's presented to me, you know, I'm gonna do what I can, and whatever, you know, happens. But I give them my best shot. So I guess that's how it's changed. I mean, it used to be, you know, work the steps or die, you know, get into the book now, you know, I mean, bang, bang, bang. And that's a really good, best sponsors in the world, 2 to 8 years. If they're still smoking, you know, then they really are righteous, because they can really tell you how to do it, because they're still right all the time.
They know everything.
Everything. But anyway, so that's enough out of me.
What's your experience in being resentful towards the people in AA and feeling unaccepted and disliked by them?
He's looking right at you.
Jay, take that.
Yeah, can you repeat the question?
Okay, the question is, how do you deal with the fact that people hate you in Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, the old saw is, it's better to give a resentment than to get one. And I don't stand against anybody. I'm true to myself. And we have a really big and wide life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've got this little funny meeting, the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, And for some reason, God has made it so that there are like 7 or 8 of us that do this kind of stuff. It's really quite remarkable. And it's because we're safe to be around and that we won't engage or tell somebody that their style of AA is right or wrong. But Alcoholics Anonymous, and it may be more a societal thing, is doers get criticized. And they're generally criticized by people that don't do. And so I don't worry about it. Thanks.
Jay and I have a little joke we do. We look at each other, we're heading somewhere like here, and we'll look at each other and go, "Where are they going now? Who do they think they are?" You know? And today in my life, I have, and I honestly mean this, I have no resentments. There's no one that I hate in AA or anywhere, really. There are people I choose not to hang around with. There are toxic people. And I think I was on the fringe of that or in that in my early days in AA. Very opinionated, very... I mean, there's just some people that just feed off of negative energy, you know? They want to tear you down in order to make themselves feel better. I've had a couple of long relationships with people that, depending upon how you look at it, they turned on me, would be the phrase I would initially use. You know, they turned on me. And I don't think today that that's the case. I think people just do what they do, and I happen to be in the blast radius. And, you know, my mistake is I take it personal when it's really not. That's the real engine, the fire that breeds resentment, is the illusion that somebody actually did something to me, that what they did was pointed at me, when the truth is anybody could have been standing in that room. I just happened to be there, and they had their little seizure or fit or whatever it was, you know.
Well, there was a couple of times.
Yeah. There were people back in the day who really attacked me, and it was for just cause. You know, it behooved me to finally sit and listen to what they were trying to say to me, because I was attacking them, and I thought I was right, therefore justified in doing what I was doing. So I was one of those people, feeding off of that negative energy, building myself up, you know, climbing over dead bodies in my rise to stardom, you know. And it was when you finally see that and realize it and look at it, it's an ugly thing. You know, I don't like that in me. I don't believe I'm like that anymore. I'm done with that. I don't have anything to prove anymore. You know, so the fellowship is something to be survived. You know, I mean, we're all just practicing on each other how to be friends, how to be lovers, you know. We're just practicing because we don't know. I mean, we're emotionally immature, and we're practicing. So there's going to be conflict. There's going to be confusion around it. If underneath all of that, you know, the thing that happened to me is I did not run away. I wanted to a couple of times, but I didn't run away. I looked the demon in the eye with help. You know, and by that time, it wasn't just Jay. There were other people had gone through this that were trying. My friend Mike Plank that said, "Welcome to AA." You know, he helped me. He helped me. He laughed at me, but he let me know it was okay to be a fool, that it won't kill you. You won't die from this, you know. So if underneath it you're really working the steps, working the program, and doing all this work, the fellowship will then become like a warm blanket, and it will carry you through things. You know, because you begin to accept people just as they are, not how you wish they should be.
Okay, I'm a great lover of AA, and I gotta preface that with, and I'm active and all that stuff, I had a man write every delegate and assistant delegate across the United States and Canada about me and about the work that I was doing, the historical work that I was doing, and saying that I should be stopped.
Censured.
And it also went to censured. It also went to every member of the General Service Office, the General Service Board, and the Office of the Trustees. So there are times, believe me, and
I was willing to take the guy out, too.
But I got to tell you, I've got a really, really good sponsor who's very, very wise. And I don't think it took us, what, 6 weeks to work through that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was devastating.
It was awful.
On so many levels. On so many levels.
So, great question. One of the things people mistake AA for is Mensa or a country club. And, it's neither of those things. We're monkeys with machine guns in here. And I think that when we start...
That's the new t-shirt or tattoo. Go down my thigh.
HBMS, monkeys with machine guns.
So, you know, Bill used to say when I'd complain about some personality conflict in AA, he goes, if you're looking for character defects in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's like shooting fish in a barrel, right? So what I like about AA is it's the church of the broken. It's not the church of the perfect. You know, I went to the church of the perfect and felt awful all the time because I wasn't perfect. And here, we're glued together by a common disability, right? But I would say this to you. If people are rebuffing you or judging you or hating you because they don't think you're working a good enough program, the only revenge is to stay sober and help other people. And if people are judging you and hating you and rebuffing you because they think you're arrogant and you're telling everybody else how to do it, the only solution to that is to stay sober and to help other people. So these things all change. They all change. I can't remember who I hated in my first 5 years of sobriety.
That's right.
You know, and
I remember a few.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. This is just, I'll end with this, because we'll hopefully get another question. Can people raise their hands? But I went to a meeting. There was a guy I used to sponsor. I'm going to withdraw his name because people who listen would know. But I went to the Monday Night Men's Stag, and I was filled with joy. I looked around, and I listened to the music playing, and I looked at the people that I loved, and it was just, I walked out and going, why do I ever miss this meeting? Whatever excuse have I ever had to really miss this meeting? I walk out the door, and this guy comes up, and he goes, man, can you believe that? Clayton's going to be pissed about what Jim said. Do you hear what Mike said? Oh, my God. It's just bullshit. And I'm like, were you in the same meeting I was in? And I realized very clearly, it's where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And there's a prayer in the book. Some of us are sick. Treat them as you would a sick friend. If you patiently wait, like all we've said today, people will shake this stuff out. You know, I hope we help with this answer. That's all I can say. Thanks.
Thank
you. Do we have time for any more
questions?
My
dad used to say, it's the lead dog that gets kicked in the ass, but he's got the best view.
Yeah, I had a quick question. We're talking about different sponsorship, whatever. Do you guys encourage literature type meetings? And then I thought, well, wait a minute. Do you bring the 12 and 12 into your sponsorship at all? That's my question.
I always try to get people to go to step studies if they're not, because I think they're really helpful for me in hearing constant reinforcement. I'm not an anti-12 and 12 guy. I think any experience with the steps, with the early guys who were clearly paying close attention to what was happening, is helpful. I think some of the poetry in Alcoholics Anonymous is in the 12 and 12. In the seventh step, it says, where we used to consider humility a force feeding on humble pie, we now view it as the nourishing ingredient that leads to serenity. Mm-hmm. Why would I rob somebody of hearing that?
Right.
So that's my two cents.
He used to hand me all kinds of books. You know, he gave me Not God, Pass It On, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and now it's Eckhart Tolle and and Alan Watts and Adyashante and, you know, Emmett Fox. You know, I mean, him being in the history so much is we end up reading all the books that they read. And then from there onward, I mean, Bill Wilson was a seeker. So when the guy's brand new, I'll stick to the big book. If he sticks around long enough, he wants to keep reading, we'll do the 12 and 12. You know, I don't really kind of insert it in the process, only because that isn't what happened to me. There's no real reason for that. I have nothing against the 12 and 12. I think it's interesting the war that some people have about some people do the work, the steps out of the 12 and 12. I don't know how you actually are able to do that. You know, I mean, I have my opinion about that. But then there's other people that won't read it because, you know, it wasn't written by the hand of God like the big book. You know, so, I mean, the big book, he just took chunks of Oxford Group material and kind of patched it together. You know?
Excuse me. I made sure that everybody that I sponsored went to this Surf and Sand Step Study.
Right.
Was it, which was a 12 and 12 thing, you know, get that. Big book study they were doing with me, so I didn't send them off to one of those. But vital, absolutely vital. Any exposure to any of the literature is great, number one. Number two is, I forgot.
Number two doesn't matter.
Oh, it was about... I'm sorry, it was about the books and the, you know, the meetings. And, oh, the 12 and 12. I love the 12 and 12. And, but I we had a, my sponsor, Greg Haysom, used to say, the 12 and 12, oh, yeah, it's a lot of use. Try taking that on a 12-step call.
He had opinions.
He's had opinions. And he was short with them. It was incredible. But anyway, I love the book, and I'll use it you know, wherever, and you know, being a historian, I know, you know, well, it's not written like the first book. Well, he was 15 years sober more, and he actually was writing all the time. He'd never written anything up front.
Well, it didn't have all the thing from all the other first members.
Next year, or maybe the year after, my friend Bill Schaberg's book's coming out on the writing of the big book, and it's going to blast a hole in some of this, some of these things that it's just incredible, because he's done all the research, and we'll talk this afternoon about some of the people and all that stuff. But so anyway, it's all good fun.
We're a little behind, but what do you want to do, Jack?
I just wanted to ask if any of y'all had ever been too busy to sponsor people.
Oh.
Well, yeah, I'm always too busy to sponsor people, but that's no excuse to not say yes.
Jay, even when I'm doing nothing, I'm too busy.
There were times when I wasn't too busy to sponsor people. This was still when I was a sober man, armed with steps, concepts, and traditions, able to transcend everything. You have an alcoholic? Give them to me. I will help them work the steps appropriately, and we will be fine. And I also had a region that had 18 Western states. My wife didn't see me a lot. My sponsees saw me less. I didn't say no to them, but they were very underserved because there weren't cell phones in those days.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean... And sponsorship's a self-cleaning oven anyway. You know, I mean, there's really only about five that you're working with regularly one way or the other. Jaden? Huh?
Question.
Yes.
What is an AA meeting all about?
What's an AA meeting all about? Okay, so...
Well, that's too deep.
Yeah, that's the... That's a graduate school question of AA.
Yeah.
Well, can we just finish this question for a second? Is that Jay and Bill said to me, if they come to you, time will be made. You know? And what I found, you know, like, I have a disabled wife, which doesn't mean I have to constantly take care of her, but I have to take care of everything that she can't take care of, right? So I've got three children. I have a job that takes me all over the country, right? I have a lot of sponsees. And yet I'll have a guy who just got a job, is not in a relationship, doesn't have any sponsees, and he can't call me. And I'll go, why didn't you call? Oh, I was too busy. And I'm like, But what I think is, why am I not too busy? Because it's important to me.
Yeah.
You know, So one guy continually didn't call, but he's always talking about his business he was starting. I go, pretend I'm Disney and you need to land the deal.
Yeah.
And he called because it was important, right? So the point, I guess, I'm trying to say is, like, is it look like you're supposed to look? Bill says that to his sponsees. Look, I'll be available. It may not look like you think it's going to look, right? I read the book over the phone a lot because I'm doing stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Last weekend I was at a conference and I didn't want to stop this guy's flow. He's new. So we read Bill's story over the phone.
Yeah.
Those words are still irrelevant over the phone. So, I mean, yeah, no, it's in your head that you're too busy.
I use Skype.
Yeah.
I read the book with guys over Skype frequently. When I was new, I had kids growing up. I started coaching soccer. I had a business to run. I was going to work every day. I was married. You know, I was busy. So there was lots of times where these guys would come and help me set up the cones out on the soccer field. You know, I said, don't you ever tell someone I don't have time for you. I don't want to ever hear that come back to me. I'll kick your ass. You know, it may not be the way you want it. You might have to chase me. I'm busy. I have a full life. Isn't that what you want? But I have time for you. You know, they've gone in the car with me with a car full of soccer kids. And a guy just recently died, my oldest sponsee. I sponsored him for 30 years.
Mm.
My kids are going to come to the memorial. He watched those children grow up. He went to my daughter's high school graduation. He built a playhouse in the backyard for the kids. You know, I mean, these people become part of your family. The other thing, just quickly, they only come in threes.
Yeah.
They come in threes.
Yeah.
You're going to get three at a time. If you're really after it, you'll get three at a time, probably no more than that. And two of them will drop out fairly quickly, you know. And then one of them will hang in until he gets to the inventory, and then you'll have to look for three more. Most of them don't stick around, really, truly.
The other thing is, I had a guy by the name of Fred Ellis as a sponsor. He's one of the great A members of all time. He's like class of 65, and I mean, he was a great guy. And Fred said, and this is back in order to have a conversation with your sponsor, you both had to be standing next to a wall at the same time to have a phone call. And he said to me, Jay, you will not be able to get a hold of me when you want to, but if you ever need me, you'll be able to get me.